Thank you, Arturo. Yeah, I'd like to thank the organizers for the invitation to come to Toronto. Let me first say that everything in sight in my talk is finite dimensional. However, upon speaking to some people at this conference, I think that there will be some generalizations to the infinite dimensional setting for affine Lie algebras. So I'll let you maybe come up with those. Okay, so what I want to first talk about are support varieties. I should actually write down the list board first. Let's push it up. So support varieties. For Lie algebras. Okay, so most of this work that I'm going to talk about at the beginning is from a paper written by Friedlander and Partial back in 1986, which appears in Inventiones. So this is from Friedlander and Partial. Inventiones math. Okay, so here's the setup. So G is a restricted Lie algebra. So it's a Lie algebra, but it also has a pth power map, noted by P. And so I'm going to be working over an algebraically closed field of characteristic P. All right, so with a restricted Lie algebra, I'm going to associate to it the restricted enveloping algebra. So let's call it U of G. And this is the quotient of the ordinary enveloping algebra. So you take the ordinary universal enveloping algebra, and you quotient it out by the ideal generated by x to the p minus x to the pth power. Okay? So when you actually truncate this or quotient this algebra out, you get a finite dimensional Hopf algebra. So this is a finite dimensional, actually co-commutative Hopf algebra. All right, so now we're going to talk about cohomology. But instead of looking at cohomology in just one degree, we're going to look at sort of all the cohomology. So let's look at the cohomology ring. So I'm going to take the even part of the cohomology ring of UG with coefficients in the trivial module. Now, there are several things we can actually say about this ring. First of all, it's going to be commutative because we take the even dimensional part, but it's also finitely generated. So this is commutative and finitely generated. So now what we can do is we can actually look at the spectrum of this ring. But before we do that, I'm going to sort of introduce other things which are related to the spectrum of this ring using representation theory. So let's let M be a module for U of G. And now it turns out that this commutative ring is going to act on the extensions of UG of M for M by itself. Okay, so you can kind of see how this is going to work. You take an extension of K by itself. You have U of G being a Hopf algebra. You just tensor that extension by M. And if you take an extension in here, you just concatenate the extension. So that's how R acts on this. So now, what we do is we let J be the annihilator of R acting on this. And so now I could form this affine homogeneous variety. So this is denoted by VG of M. This will be just the maximum ideal spectrum of R over J of M. So for each U of G module, what we do is we've associated an affine homogeneous variety. And this is called the support variety of M. Now, one simple fact that we should realize is that if I take the trivial module, right, the support variety of the trivial module will be sort of the biggest module, biggest variety. So let me just state a fact that if you take support variety of M, it always lives inside the support variety of K, where K is the trivial module. Okay. All right. So now you're probably saying to yourself, well, this is all fine and good, but what can you actually do with this? You have kind of an abstract definition up here. I mean, can we actually realize these varieties in a very natural way? And that was the contribution by Friedlander and Partial. Okay, so this definition actually originated from work in group algebras by John Carlson, and then Friedlander and Partial extended the work for restricted Lie algebras. So let's see what these varieties look like. So there's a spectral sequence. So it doesn't matter, what this is. I just want to point out one part about the spectral sequence. So the E2 term looks like the symmetric algebra on the dual of the Lie algebra with the ordinary Lie algebra cohomology, just like in the last talk, and it converges to H2i plus j to the restricted Lie algebra cohomology. Now, you can obtain this spectral sequence by looking at the dual of U of G and then sort of filtering it by the powers of the augmentation ideal. Now, the nice thing about the spectral sequence is you have the symmetric algebra over here. And it gives you an edge homomorphism which goes from the symmetric algebra down to the cohomology. So let me call this rho. So this goes from the symmetric algebra down to the even dimensional cohomology. So it turns out this is a nice map because it's a finite map of rings. Right? So the image is going to be this is going to be a finite extension over its image. So now I can look at the induced map on varieties. And so what happens? Well, the spectrum of this is just the support variety of the trivial module. And that's going to go to, well, it's finite. You have to look, it comes in because of the spectral sequence. Right? It turns out that this is all part. That's right. It all comes from the spectral sequence. All right, so you take the spectrum of this. Well, what's the spectrum of this? Well, it's just the affine space of the Lie algebra. So now I have a map from the variety into the Lie algebra. And it turns out you can say a lot about this. Okay, this is work of Suslin, Friedlander, and Bendel, and also by Janssen, older work by Janssen. So they show the following. So if you take support variety of K, right, then it turns out to be isomorphic to its image under this map. And Janssen actually showed what the image is. It's going to be the set of elements in the Lie algebra whose pth power is going to be 0. So this, of course, sits inside of the Lie algebra. So he completely characterized what this image is going to be. Now, moreover, Friedlander and Partial were able to use this result by Janssen and say what the image is under any module. So if I take VG of M, this is going to be the same as the image of VG of M. And this turns out to be the set of all elements in G whose pth power is 0. And when I take the module, and if I take if I take X, then I can look at the Lie algebra generated by X. That's just one dimensional. So I can restrict it down to this universal enveloping algebra, this one-dimensional algebra. If this is not free, that's the condition. And then you just throw in 0. Okay, so they showed that you can completely completely say what the image of this variety is under this map. Okay. So the next thing I want to do is I want to start with something. Yes. This is true for arbitrary. Yeah. Now I'm going to go to semi-simple. All right. So let's talk about reductive groups. So, two, say something about reductive groups. Okay, so I'm just going to put down standard notation. All right, so G is going to be a connected reductive algebraic group. K is going to be equal to FP bar. So for this talk, if you want to think of just the general linear group, that'll be fine too. You should always keep that example in mind. So B is the Borel given under a maximal torus. Phi will be the set of roots. This is probably bad notation from the previous talks, but this is the simple roots. Okay, not all the roots, just the simple roots. Okay. Let's let XT be the weights. XT plus be the dominant integral weights, or dominant weights. Okay, W is a Weyl group. Believe it or not, I'm going to need all this notation. Rho is the half sum of positive roots. Okay, let's see. Alpha check is the coroot. And then H is the Coxeter number. Okay, and I think I have a little room. So the script G will mean the Lie algebra for G. Okay, so what we want to do next is we want to look at this theory in the case of reductive groups and just translate what we mean by some of these constructions. So there's a famous object that many people have studied in connection with reductive groups, and this is called the nilpotent cone. So let's script N be the set of X and G such that X is nilpotent. So this is often called the null cone. Some people call it the nilpotent cone. All right, so if you look at this set here, the set of all X and G such that X to P is equal to 0, well, that's going to sit inside of here. Yeah, you just take like the Jordan-Chevalier decomposition. You know, we're in the reductive group situation. XS plus XN. Right, okay. Yeah, okay. So now you look at this set of elements such that X to P is equal to 0. So another way to think about it is you're just asking, like, if you take GLN, whether the pth power of the matrix is going to be 0. That certainly sits inside of here. And this is called the restricted null cone. So let's call this the restricted null cone. Right? Now, let me just review a few facts about the ordinary null cone. So this affine algebraic variety has been very well studied. And so here are a few facts. So first, it turns out this is an irreducible variety. So script N is an irreducible variety. What's its dimension? Dimension is equal to twice the number of positive roots. Okay. It's actually the closure of an orbit. So this G acts on N by conjugation. Okay. All right, so we know that G acts on N by conjugation, and you can ask how many orbits you have. So it turns out N has finitely many orbits. I think this is a result which is due to Lustig. Okay. Now it turns out there's many cases when these two varieties coincide. So if P is large enough, then these two are going to be equal. So if P is bigger than the Coxeter number, then it turns out that N is actually equal to N1 of G. Okay, so for primes which are large enough, you have equality. So the interesting case will be when primes are small, below the Coxeter number. And then finally, the orbits have been classified. The orbits have been classified. So like using a weighted Dinkin diagrams, or you can have partition type classifications for the classical algebras. You beg your pardon? Yeah, that's right. For all P. It turns out when P is good, then the orbits in characteristic 0 coincide with the orbits in characteristic P. Okay, if P is bad, then you have a few more you have to deal with. All right? So if you'd like for this talk, because I'm going to assume that P is good later on, you could just assume it's like the characteristic 0 theory, right, which you're probably more familiar with. Okay, and finally, this is going to be stable under the action of G. So N1G is G stable. Okay, so there are two open problems. Which I want to present. These are from the Friedlander and Partial work. So these problems appeared at the end of their paper. So let me call these P1 and P2. So first problem was, is the restricted null cone an irreducible variety? Okay. For reductive G. Turns out it's not always true. I mean, there's lots of examples where it's not irreducible. Problem two. So let W be a G stable conical subvariety of N1G. Okay. So is there a finite dimensional rational G module M? So this is a realization problem, such that the support variety of M is going to be equal to W. Okay, so I take a subvariety inside of here, which is stable under the action of G. I want to find a module whose support variety is actually equal to M. Yeah, go on. Closed subvariety. Yeah, closed, I guess. I beg your pardon? Yeah. Yes. Yeah. It probably is. I just wanted to. Yeah. Yeah, maybe I don't need the conical. Maybe I should just collect that. Okay. So this is a realization question that we want to try to address in this talk. It turns out that problem two is motivated by a theorem of John Carlson. And I'll just say what the theorem says. It says that if I take any conical closed subvariety inside of N1G, then there exists a finite dimensional U of G module. So U of G meaning this U of G, such that the support variety is realized. So it's okay for U of G modules, but we don't know whether it's true for actual G modules for the group. Okay. Yeah?
P2 has an atomic diameter, or even there it's not known.
No, there it's not known either.
But P gets limited length.
Yeah, still not known. Even after this talk, it's still not known. Okay, so next thing I need to talk about is something called the Janssen conjecture. Okay, so we're going to assume that P is good. Okay, so this was introduced in one of the earlier talks. It means that P is not like 2, 3, or 5 for E8, for example. So just low primes. Okay. All right, so for a dominant weight, let's look at these modules, H0 lambda. So this is induction from B to G of lambda. Another way to think about this is like in Kumar's talk, you sort of look at these line bundle cohomology. Okay? So the character of these modules is just given by Weyl's character formula, even in characteristic P. Right? And it turns out these modules are not irreducible in characteristic P in general. So your irreducible module sits inside the socle of these modules. Okay? It's not known what the structures of these modules are. Okay. So for any character, I'm going to define the set, the stabilizer set. This is the set of all roots, such that lambda plus rho, alpha check, is a multiple of P. Okay, so this actually is a set of roots. And for P good, it turns out to be actually a subroot system of phi, as long as it's not empty. So since it's a subroot system, there exists a W. Such that W phi lambda is going to be phi sub j. So this is the subroot system generated by a subset of simple roots. So what could happen is this subroot system may not contain a base, or the ordinary base. But what this is saying is that you can actually take this and conjugate it by something in the Weyl group so that you get a nice base of simple roots, the subroot system. Okay. All right, so now I need to say, let's see, I think I'll keep this, pull this one down. Okay, so now if I take a subset of simple roots, I can decompose my Lie algebra as uj, lj, uj plus. Okay, and so here's a theorem that was proved a couple years ago by myself and then Brian Parshall and Dave Vella. So around 2000, it appeared in 2003 or 2002. So this theorem actually says what the support varieties are for these modules, these H0 lambdas, for all good primes. So here's the answer. So for lambda in XT plus and P good, okay, let W be in W such that W phi lambda is phi J. Okay, so then you decompose your Lie algebra in this way, and the answer is the following. So then the support variety for H0 lambda is equal to G times UJ. So you take this UJ and you just saturate it by the action of G. Okay? Now, it turns out that in this theory, I mean, it's a nice theory and everything, but there are many examples that were lacking. I mean, many computations that were lacking. And so this is one of the first results in terms of actually computing support varieties for important classes of modules. Okay. So. All right. Right. So this is for the vial module. Absolutely. Yeah, it's still open what the supports are for the irreducibles. Although if the Lustig conjecture is true, then it turns out to be the same for the regular case. It turns out. But that's all we can say so far. Okay. So let me say a little bit about this theorem. So Janssen actually formulated this conjecture. In 1987, and he proved it for GLN. Okay. And I should say something about this set over here. It turns out that this set is actually the closure of an orbit. So G times UJ is actually going to be the closure of an orbit, and orbits which arise in this way are called Richardson. So these are called Richardson orbits. Not everything is Richardson. In type A, everything is, but not in general. Okay. So now, I beg your pardon?
I don't understand. So only those UJs will appear in your theorem, which have Richardson orbits.
Yeah. So. The only things that will rise as supports for the H0s will be Richardson orbits. Okay? And that's going to partly address some of the other issues. Okay, so let's see. What's the corollary of this? The corollary actually solves, in part, problem number one. So let G be reductive. And P good. Okay. So then, script N1G is an irreducible variety. Okay, so I'm going to give you a representation theoretic proof for this, one-line proof. So how does this go? Well, if I take, I told you before that if you take the support variety of the trivial module, you get N1G. So that's the same thing as a support variety for H0 lambda. So this is a N1G here. So by the Janssen conjecture, this is going to be equal to G times UJ for some J. And that does it. Okay, so because we've been able to realize N1G in terms of a support variety, we're able to get the irreducibility out in this way. So it shows that with this setup, it turns out to be quite useful because, I mean, you could try to work with just the set of matrices whose p power is 0 here and try to prove irreducibility that way, but I think this is a little bit more cleaner once you have the setup.
Okay.
All right, so let me make a couple remarks. Yeah? N1B. Okay, that'll be part of my remarks. So, remark. Okay, one. N1B, so B is equal to the Lie algebra of the Borel, is not irreducible. For p less than h. Okay, so it turns out there are examples of Lie algebras where the restricted null cone is not irreducible. I don't think it's going to be irreducible when p is bad either. I think we have some counterexamples of that. Okay, and the second thing I want to say is for p bad, nothing is known. Currently is known. So we don't know whether this variety is irreducible or not, and we don't know whether we don't know how to compute the supports of the eight zeros. That's still up in the air. Okay, so we don't have a conjecture here for the cases when P is bad. Okay. Now, the next question you should probably ask is, well, you have this variety, you know it's irreducible, so what is it? I mean, how do you actually, what's the dimension of N1G, and can I actually find a subset of simple roots J which actually characterize what the variety is going to be? So that was done by Carlson, Lynn, myself, and Partial. The paper appeared in 2003. I'll call it CLNP for short. 2003. Okay. So we determined the following. The first thing we determined was the dimension of the restricted null comb in all types. Okay, so we know the dimensions. And we also determined representatives J inside of the simple roots, such that N1G is equal to G times UJ. Okay, so we actually found representatives of simple roots such that this equality holds. So what I'd like to do next is just show you an example of how the machinery in this theorem can be used to actually compute out an example of the restricted null comb. So let's do that. I think I can erase this board. Okay, so here's the example. And this will show you, I hope this example shows you how easy this machinery is to use. I'm trying to promote that. So we know that the restricted null cone is going to be G times UJ, okay, for some J. We also know what the dimension of N1G is, too. So this is a Richardson orbit, so it's going to be twice the dimension of UJ. Okay. And another way to write this is in terms of positive roots and it's in the stabilizer. So this is just going to be equal to the number of roots minus the number of roots in phi sub j. And remember that w phi 0, remember 0 is the 0 weight, that's going to be equal to phi sub j. So this is part of the setup here. Okay? So the number of roots doesn't change, of course. So this is going to be equal to phi minus phi 0. Okay, so we have to look at what phi 0 is very carefully. Okay, so let me write that definition out. So this is the set of roots such that, so I'll erase the lambda in a second. So lambda rho alpha check is in PZ. Okay, so lambda here is 0. So it's just the roots such that when I take rho alpha check, they're multiple of p. Well, I guess I'm going to work in a certain case. So let me just work in the simply lace case because that'll be easier. So this is something nice and combinatorial you can do. So let's do E8. Let's try p equals 11. Okay, so p here is less than the Coxeter number. So what do? I look at all the roots for E8, which have height a multiple of 11, right? So you have 11 or 22. Okay, so look at roots of height 11 or 22. Okay, can't go farther than that. That's not hard to do. You just get like Bremner's book on Lie algebras, or you know, some book which has all the roots in it. You just look at which ones have the right height. And this is going to be a subroot system. And you can tell, you can see immediately that the base is going to be consists of roots of height 11, right? And then you can just write out what the subroot system is that you get. And you get an A2 cross A2 cross A1 cross A1. Okay, so that's not hard to do. So now we have the dimension of the variety. We can just compute it out. So the dimension of N1G in this case, well, the number of roots in E8, what's that, 240? And then I have to subtract the number of roots inside of here. Okay, so I get 6 plus 6 plus 2 plus 2. Okay, so I get 224. Okay, so the dimension of the N1G is 224. We know it's a Richardson orbit. Okay. But I said all the orbits are classified. So you just look at the table. So there are two orbits of dimension 224. There are two possible orbits. There's the orbit O. This is the Balla-Carter label, E8, A6. Okay, so this orbit turns out to be even, so it has to be Richardson. And then there's the orbit O of E7, A2. So it turns out that this is Richardson, and this one's not. Okay. So you rule it out by tables given by Hirai or Elavishi. So they listed all the orbits which are, you know, not. They listed all the orbits which are Richardson in that case. So then that's the answer. So N1G is going to be equal to O of E8, A6 quotient. Okay, so in this procedure, what we did was we only had to compute out the heights of roots to compute out what the varieties are. And it gave us a way to do this very explicitly. And that's the way we handle things in the paper. There are a couple cases where you have more than, you have two Richardson orbits of the same dimension. There you have to use the Weyl group and use more careful analysis to pick off things. Okay. So that sort of answers in part P1. Let me just move this board again. So now I want to look at P2. So let's look at the question of realization. Okay, so let me write out P2 again. I'm going to reformulate this just like Olivia did in his talk, although this reformulation is sort of a trivial reformulation. So given an orbit O inside the restricted null cone, right? So find a finite dimensional rational G module M such that O VG of M is equal to O bar. Okay, so that's the restatement of the problem. Because if you take any G invariant subvariety, we know that it's going to be a union of orbit closures. And support varieties turn out to behave very well with respect to direct sums. So if you take the direct sum of two modules, it's going to be equal to the union of the supports. Okay? So that's one fact you can use. And then this is just going to be the closure of orbits. Finitely magnified. So you just realize one orbit closure at a time, and then just take the direct sum of the modules, and you're okay. Okay, so this is a easy reformulation of the problem in terms of orbits. So here we're trying to realize orbits, orbit closures, in terms of support varieties for modules. Okay. Push this. All right, so the first theorem does things for Richardson orbits. So this is, again, due to CLNP. And it says the following. So let O be a Richardson orbit. Okay. In N1G. Okay. So then, P2 holds. Okay, so for Richardson orbits, everything is okay. Now, let's think about the Janssen conjecture for a moment. I erased it. So the Janssen conjecture says that when you take the Weyl modules and you take their supports, you get Richardson orbits, or Richardson orbit. So you get a certain subset of Richardson orbits. So this is saying the converse. So if I take a Richardson orbit, then actually I can realize it as the support variety. If I take its closure, I can realize it as a support variety for some G module. Okay, so this is sort of the converse to the Janssen conjecture. So this is the, let me just say it's the converse to the J conjecture. All right, so what does the proof use? It uses a lot of things. So one thing it uses is it uses this Lustig-Spaltenstein induction of orbits. Okay, so we needed to use this to realize the Richardson orbits of types B, C, and D. What else does it use? It uses the Janssen conjecture for type A. It uses the classical embeddings. So you try to realize these, you realize these groups inside of GLN. So you use, so let's say this is like SPV or something like that. You realize it in terms of here, and then you take the orbit theory of this and you pull it back. That's part of the ideas. And then finally, for the exceptional cases, we had to use computer calculations. So we used the computer to actually do this. And then with the computer calculations, we had to use the Hasse diagrams for the exceptional groups. Okay, so there's a lot of things that actually go into this theorem. Okay, so that was sort of the end of the CLNP paper. And last summer I went to Japan. Yeah, so these turn out to be H0s. I'm gonna address that in a second. Okay, this is your question is a very good question. I'm gonna address this. Okay, so this is work that that we completed last year in Japan, and so we extended these results to other orbits in the following way. So this is work with Tanasaki in 2003. So let phi be equal to an, bn, cn, or dn. Okay? So if O is any orbit inside of N1 of G, then there exists a Tilke module. M, such that VG of M is equal to O bar. Okay, so a tilting module is a module which has a filtration with sections of Weyl modules and has another filtration with sections being induced modules. And so you can actually realize these orbits for the classical types via just tilting modules. I beg your pardon? That's right. This is any orbit for this, for P good. Okay? Now, if O is Richardson, um, Then this holds. For phi arbitrary. Okay, so you can actually do better by realizing in terms of a tilting module. Let me say that the tilting modules look like they're the right class of modules to use to represent orbit closures. The simple modules are not. Because if you take types B2 or C2, the minimal orbit cannot be realized as the support variety of a simple module. Okay, so the simple modules don't seem like the right class of modules to use for this type of realization, but the tilting modules do. Let me also say that this is consistent with Humphrey's conjecture. He has a conjecture involving the supports of tilting modules, which I think is in like this conference proceeding that Yvonne organized. And there he actually gives a connection between the supports of tilting modules and these two-sided cells. Right. Okay. All right. So that's the first theorem. And then turns out we could do a little better but not saying exactly what the modules are. So this is NT. So P2 holds for phi AN, BN, CN, DN, F4, and G2. Okay, so we can realize everything at least for F4 and G2 now. So now it's where things are kind of open, but not too open. So let's look at E6, E7, and E8. Okay, so it turns out that we can realize most of the orbits in this situation except a certain few. And I'll say what the few are in a second. So P2 holds. Okay, for all but the possible, I don't know, we don't know whether these can be realized yet or not, exceptions. Okay, so let me write some of these down. So for E6, it turns out there's only one that we can't get yet. So this is the orbit OA5, this non-Richardson orbit. And it turns out that we need P bigger than or equal to 11. So for P equals 5 and 7, everything is okay, turns out, via our methods. But this is actually just for the large primes, not the real small ones. Okay? So for E6, there are four of them. There's O of D6. O of D6A2, I don't have all these in my head, so O of A5 prime, its orbit, and O of A5 plus A1. Here again, P is bigger than 7, and so P equals 5 is okay. So P equals 5 turns out to be okay for certain reasons. And then for E8, there are 10 that we can't realize yet. I won't write them all down, so unrealized orbits. Okay. So in order to do this, what we have to do is we have to use the adjoint representation, and we have to pull back the orbit theory for GLN to these exceptional algebras. Okay, so that's kind of the trick to use. So let me give you the idea of how to do this. So here's the idea. So what you do is you use the adjoint representation. So again, let's say that phi is exceptional here. So you take your Lie algebra and you embed it into GL of G. So this is the adjoint representation. Okay. Actually, associated with this, we have G going into GL of G, too. Okay, so there's actually been quite a bit of work done in terms of unipotent elements, right? So here's the main question. So if I take an orbit in here, so the orbit in here is just going to be labeled by some partition, right? And we just want to intersect it with G, right? Now, it turns out that when you intersect it with G, in most cases, you get one orbit back, right? But the problem is when you take the closure. So you want to know what the closure of the orbit intersected with G is. And sometimes, this is just going to be one orbit, and sometimes it's not. And in these cases, it turns out that when you intersect this orbit associated with lambda, so you take an element here in G, and then you sort of push it over and find out what partition you get, and you intersect it down, you get a union of orbit closures, right? And so you can't really realize in this way. But if this is a single orbit closure, then you can do the following. So the support variety is very natural with respect to this sort of inclusion. So this is VG of M, right? So what you can do, right, is you can realize this orbit over here. You can intersect it down. You'll get this. If this is an orbit closure, you're done. If it's a union of orbit closures, well, you may have some troubles. Now, even if it's a union, then you can still try to work with the Hasse diagram and try to intersect orbit closures down and use the fact that the tensor product, so VG of the tensor product of two modules, is just the intersection of the two varieties. Okay. So you can use this fact to actually clean out more cases if you can't realize them in terms of just a single orbit closure. And so that's what analysis has actually done in these cases and also the F4 and G2 case, too, in order to try to answer this question. So in order to finish off this problem, I don't know whether the answer is going to be true or false yet. I mean, I think it'll probably be true if Humphrey's conjecture is true. But I think you're going to need more powerful methods. It'll be interesting to see what sort of methods one can actually develop in order to realize these additional orbits that you can't realize in this way. So with that, I think I'll stop. Thanks for your time. Thank you.